to Edge of the Earth. It's a fascinating topic, and there's a lot of debate about it, apart from in the scientific world, in the Torah world as well. It's a fundamental issue to understand. First of all, it's fascinating in its own right, and secondly, there's a lot of questions of Emunah, and other people who are struggling with Jewish belief, who feel that it's necessary to answer, to deal with issues like evolution, the age of the earth, and so forth, because they seem to pose problems and raise contradictions to the Torah model of the scientific, of the progression of history, let's say, geographical history and so forth. And it seems to be a very wide disparity between the scientific account of the age of the universe and between what we have explicit in Torah tradition. The truth is, from the outset, you should know that there's no conflict between these things at all, because the two, as is often said, in any area where Torah and science seem to impinge on each other, that they're dealing with totally different paradigms. They're dealing with totally different systems, universes, their language terms of reference are different, and therefore you never really have to engage in a conflict between the two. But the point is that often it's seen that way, and it needs some depth to disentangle the possible areas of conflict. Now, first of all, let's state the problem in terms of the age of the earth. I want to try and avoid the evolution thing as much as possible, although inevitably it impinges on this question. And we'll have to raise some of the problems and some of the issues that are raised by evolutionists. And please feel free to ask anything you want as we go along. I was told that I was giving this talk a very short period of time ago, so it might not be perfectly organized. Please raise any questions that I may not deal with fully. The problem, to state it simply, is the following thing. According to Torah tradition, the world is 5,748 years old. Okay? That date dates from Friday, 5,748 years ago, the Friday of the first 6 days of creation when Adam was created. The month happened to be either Tishrei or Nisan, according to discussion in the Gemara, and that's exactly what it was. The accurate tradition going back there, corroborated in Torah sources many times over, right down to a period of some hours discrepancy because of when the sun was stopped by Yahushua, okay, where the astrological computations has to be changed according to the Torah calendar, which is discussed by the sages and fixed now for us. We have now a fixed calendar. So it's quite clear what the age of the earth is in Torah terms. The scientific account of the age of the earth is a very big question. Tremendous debate, right, with a tremendous range of opinions. As you know, the scientific methods which are brought to bear on this question all have certain very big problems. We're not here to discredit any scientific method. On the contrary, I would like to try and take a line today which will show you that most of the scientific work is perfectly consistent with Torah thinking, and we don't have to discredit it at all. But first, let's get things in perspective, that discussing a subject like this in scientific terms is the weakest area of science. What science has to say about areas like this, right? I'm not saying this to discredit them. On the contrary, as I said before, we have to understand that these are issues which science has the weakest say about. The simple reason is that we're dealing with areas that have a number of scientific problems. First problem is that whatever we're going to say can never be checked. Right? At the moment, we do not have a technique of going back 10 billion years, right, and hoping to get back there intact and see what happens. We don't have that option open to us. So it's all supposition, and there's no way to test it. And by definition, many scientific philosophers of science, define the scientific method as being a process by which one postulates a theory and then sets about testing it in the lab or sets about making the observations that will verify or break down the theory. In the area of the age of the earth, there is no way to set about testing your hypothesis. There's no way to set up an experiment that will check it out, and there's no way to go back and observe the phenomenon. So that makes it a very weak, and according to some philosophers of science, it makes it an area which is not valid to apply the term science to. It's an area of speculation, call it whatever you want, speculation, scientific observation, but to call it a science and attack it as a scientific hypothesis to be checked out is just not valid in the first place. That's a big important point to remember. Another important point to remember, these points have been very eloquently made in a letter contained, which you can read in English in a book called Challenge. There's a very, very elegant and eloquent letter there going through the issues involved in the age of the earth and dealing with the question of evolution to some extent from a theoretical scientific point of view. No Torah input at all, just a purely scientific theoretical point of view. Speak to me afterwards, I'll give you that reference if you want the exact place. The things which are mentioned there, which are, should be quite clear, are that another scientific problem with dealing with a situation like this is that we are reasoning, right, from present to antecedent. Now, you know that most all science seeks to postulate the hypothesis and then predict phenomena on the basis of the hypothesis. Now, the way science usually does that is, as I'm sure you're aware, we make a series of observations. Let's take a classical scientific situation. We may, let's say, postulate that situation like this. Let's say we will graph a phenomenon, right? Let's say this will be let's say we have on one axis, just for example, like temperature. We'll plot temperature over here, and on this axis we'll plot volume, let's say of a liquid, okay, for example. And we start plotting what happens to the volume of a given liquid with change in temperature. Well, if we plot it, and we find, as we do, for all known liquids, with the exception of water, which we won't go into now, which is an open miracle, by the way. You know that if you plot the graph of expansion of water with temperature, you have a totally unpredicted anomaly, which is a fascinating observation, which bears very much on this thing. But let's leave that up for the moment. If you plot substances with temperature, you get a straight line, or you get a predictable, mathematically described equation. Now, science does not seek to measure every infinitesimally different point on the graph in order to prove its point. What it does is it measures a random sample. That means we'll measure the volume of water at 4 degrees, we'll measure it at 20 degrees, at 50, etc., and up to 100. Let's say that's what we'll do. So we plot only specific points on the graph. And then we interpolate, right, by drawing a line connecting the points, and we then theorize that although we never measured the volume of water at 45.62 degrees, right, but its volume will probably lie on a point connecting the two points on either side of it that we measured. Now, scientifically and logically, you can see immediately that there's absolutely no reason why it should be true. There's no reason at all why it should be true. Accurately, logically, culturally, scientifically speaking. Because you measure a straight line graph like this, and because you can measure this point and show that at this temperature the volume is this, and at this temperature the volume is that, does not tell you at all that on the point in between the volume will be intermediate between those two volumes. There's absolutely no logical reason why it should be that way. Is that clear to everybody? It does not have to be at all. For all you know, the true picture of this graph, which you plotted by plotting these points, may be like this. Right? That may be the graph. There's absolutely no scientific reason why it shouldn't be that way. And it will still pass through the points that you measured and be true. But experience has shown us, right? Experience with dealing with the world has shown us that if you put the simplest common denominator through a set of observations, very often it holds true. And it's a logical and practical way to set about dealing with the world. And the more experience you have with points in between, the more you will, with more confidence will you be able to predict the phenomenon in intervals that you haven't measured. You have to always remember, it's a philosophical point, it's a Torah point, and it's a very important and basic scientific fundamental, that not only is it theoretically invalid, but in practice, they're often surprises. The classical example I mentioned before is that if you took every known liquid in the universe and measured its temperature between 5 degrees and 100 degrees, including water, you would get the same pattern. And if you interpolated in between, made your predictions in between, then you would find that it obeys the equation. But if you then take your graph and extract a prediction beyond the limits that you examined. Let's say you then predict what will be, you examined the limits between here and here, and you did it in great detail in between, and you examined it at 1 degree intervals, and then at half degree intervals, and it turned out to be the same. If you then try and predict what will be the volume of your liquid at this temperature, beyond the rates that you experimented with, right,
and then you then predict that it will, your mind will continue to a given point, that is not interpolation anymore, but extrapolation, right? Taking out an observation from a known range. That's a much weaker scientific method, right? That's a method of induction which is much weaker than having explored both sides. There's no logical reason why it should be, but experience shows that as soon as you move out of a known range, your chances of predicting accurately a phenomenon are much less. Because many scientific phenomena do a thing like this, and then it starts to occur, right? Such as when you reach a boiling point, there are many cutoff points beyond which your observation changes. Much less likely when you've examined both sides of the range. As you all know, and I mentioned before, if you do this experiment with all known liquids and substances, you'll find a constant relationship. According to the practical way of dealing with science, if you then took a substance that you had not ever seen before and predicted that it would follow the same pattern, you would have a very, very high order of probability of being right. Or, if you took another substance and then checked out its volume at a temperature that you had never checked it out in practice, statistically you would have a very, very high order of probability of being correct. But the facts are not like that. If you take water and you measure its volume in this known range, no matter how carefully you do it, if you then start to check out water beyond this range, you measure the volume of water at 3 degrees, 2 degrees, and 1 degree centigrade, you'll find that the volume is larger than predicted by the straight line. That's a clear miracle, and an outright miracle, as any scientist will agree, and you can understand the reason, I'm kidding you, but the reason you can understand it's plain, is that if water did not do that, the consequence would be that we wouldn't be here. Because as water gets cooler and closer to its freezing point, it becomes denser, like all volume. If it continued that way and became its densest at zero, which means froze, denser than it was as a liquid, ice would sink. Clear? Clear, right? Which means that lakes and oceans would freeze from the bottom up. Right? Which would mean that after one winter, anything that was alive in that sea before is frozen solid and dead now. And the life cycle on Earth ceases. What happens? Water becomes, water expands as it reaches its freezing point, becomes less dense, floats, and seals the lake, right, with warm water underneath. You know, the ice is a very good insulator, and it seals the body of water and allows fish and life to continue living underneath through the winter, so that the world continues. That is a clear, clear piece of design in the physical universe. I don't think anybody can see it any different. But since today we're talking about pure science, we won't go to the religious implications. Now, dealing with the age of the earth applies this principle to an extreme degree. We are not looking at a phenomenon that fits into the range of observed measurements. We're looking at something that's outside the range. And in this case, it happens to be way outside the range. You have to understand that if we can make observations like this for water, let's say, and then extend it slightly beyond the range, we're in danger. Right? You have to be very clear. If you make measurements on water in this range and then we then interpolate something in the middle, we're in a danger zone. But experience shows that it's a reliable way and a practical way to set about dealing with the world. If you then make measurements beyond the observed range, it's also a reasonable way to deal with the world. Experience shows it often to be valid, usually to be valid, but it's dangerous, as we've just shown. But if you take a system where you measure in the following fashion, you have some parameter that you control, you measure here, and you measure an observed change over here. And you then measure a graph in this range. Right? And you get a straight line, or you get a mathematically expressible function. And you then want to know what the function would look like at this point here, where the order of magnitude between here and here, and here and here is many, many, many fold. Well, you're in a hopeless area. Extrapolating to a hopeless degree. When you measure phenomena in the age of the earth, we see how things change and age and form and so forth, and we measure those phenomena over a lifetime, even over a number of lifetimes. We go back to the beginning of scientific observation, right? And we measure it over the last 300-400 years. And you want to extrapolate back to 10 billion years ago, what things looked like 10 billion years ago. You understand? You got a hopeless degree of extrapolation beyond it.
Yes.
So it's nothing more than pure speculation what things would have been. I want to give you a classical application of this principle, because dating systems, and it's a very good example to base this understanding on, dating systems fall into this trap to a degree that's extreme. Let me illustrate to you the following example. One of the commonest dating methods is carbon dating. Now,
The problem is like this. If you read a textbook at a low level, a high school textbook, a junior college textbook, they'll tell you that certain fossils were found and proven to be 50,000, 100, 200,000 years old because carbon dioxide, and that's a fact. End of story. But the facts are not like that at all. The correct scientific way to express that information would be, according to the assumptions involved in carbon dating, right, which are tremendous degree of extrapolation into a range of unknowns, and given that all the assumptions we're making within the range are correct, then it would seem that this fossil is X amount of years old. That's the scientific jargon, and pure, one second, let me just finish this point, pure logical jargon, which would be quite correct. There's such an egocentric view of these things in the scientific community, they don't bother to give you the assumptions. They say that this fossil is X amount of years old. Yeah? Let's give them the due credit that they expect you to know that there are many assumptions involved. Well, at junior level, very often people don't do that. The high school student who's reading his textbook thinks that X fossil was found, right? Just a Neanderthal skull or a piece of a jawbone or something, and it's accurately dated to be X amount of years old. If you go into the literature, you'll find that the arguments surrounding those three teeth or of the jawbone ranges over millions of years, orders of magnitude it ranges, right, first of all. And even if you had close agreements in terms of the range, you then run into the problem of a scientific invalidity. Now, let me illustrate this with the principle of carbon dating, and you'll see what I mean. It's a fascinating example. Carbon dating works like this. Let me explain to you the basis, and I'll show you how it works on the graph. Carbon dating works like this. It's very important to grasp this example because all dating systems are based on assumptions in analogous fashion. The carbon dating system works like this. You have, I'm sure most of you studied basic chemistry at school, physics, and so forth. The system works like this. You have the normal state of the carbon atom, right, which is the basis of organic life on Earth, organic chemistry. The carbon atom has a normal configuration of being C12, okay, but can be excited to what's known as carbon-14, C14, a radioactive form of carbon by cosmic radiation. The formation of carbon-14 in the atmosphere is caused by energizing of cosmic radiation, impinging on carbon molecules and exciting them to a more excitable form. Being more excitable, they're less stable, and the carbon atom spontaneously decomposes from C14 to C12 over a period of time. This period of time is usually defined scientifically and measured as what's known as a half-life. A half-life of an unstable isotope means that over the given half-life, you will have half the amount less in that form as you had at the beginning of the time period. Here's a simple example. If you measure carbon-14 in the atmosphere, and you find that the proportion of C14 to C12 in the atmosphere is X, let's say it's 4%, 5%, whatever it is, I don't know what the percentage is, then it means that if the half-life of carbon-14 is 2,000 years, it means that 2,000 years from now, in a stable sample, you'll then have only 2% carbon-14, because there's a natural decomposition breakdown, right? Is everyone with me? Now, carbon dating works in the following way. If you make the following observation, you find the following fact. If you look at carbon-14 in the atmosphere, in the ambient environment, you find that it has a certain fixed fraction, right? Certain small percentage is carbon-14. If you measure any organic material that's alive, it will, by definition, have exactly the same percentage, because carbon-14 behaves the same way exactly biologically as carbon-12. That means when an organism builds its muscle and its bone and its tissue, it uses carbon-14, and it's not fussy whether it uses C12 or C14. It makes absolutely no difference biochemically, except that you can measure radioactivity from the C14. But it makes no difference to the organism. Now, since carbon-14 is around and available in the atmosphere in the fixed percentage, it will be reflected in any organism. If you take a tree that's alive today, you'll find the same proportion of C14 to C12 in that tree as you will in the ambient environment, right?
Isn't that valid if the assumption is half-life, the fact that it's available?
I don't follow. There's no question about the half-life. Half-life is measurable. There's no argument about that. Now, you find, since the tree is in balance with its environment, it's incorporating carbon and giving off carbon, right, in its natural turnover of cells and so forth, you'll find that it's in balance with the environment. And therefore, a tree that's alive today will have the same ratio of C14 to C12 as anything else in that. But however, when the tree dies and stops metabolizing, stops taking in new carbon from the atmosphere, from the environment, then what happens is the following interesting phenomenon. You have a tree which has a stable population of C14 and C12 atoms, and the C12 atoms remain constant, nothing changes them, but the C14 breaks down. The radioactive unstable isotope breaks down with time, and it breaks down at the rate defined by the half-life, which means, and let's say the half-life of carbon-14 is 2,000 years, I don't remember, it's in that order of magnitude, I don't remember exactly what it is. If you have a fossil of a tree, if it died yesterday, its proportion of C14 to C12 will be the same as a tree that's alive. However, if it died 2,000 years ago, then it will have half the proportion of C14 to C12 as a living tree. Is that clear to everybody? And if it died 4,000 years ago, it will have a quarter. And so it goes as the half-life causes disintegration and degradation of the C14. Is that clear? Now, if you found a fossil of a tree with zero, right, very, very, very little C14, it means it's very, very old. Because the tree's been around a heck of a long time, and over those thousands of years that it's been fossilized, the C14 is constantly breaking down at the rate given by the half-life until you end up with almost no C14. And therefore you have a dating system which is which is usable. Now, okay, everybody's with me thus far, right? Now, if you think about it carefully, you'll realize that this system of dating is based on a massive assumption. Clear, right? The assumption is the following thing. Let's say you find a fossil, and you measure the C14 in the fossil, and you find that it has very little C14, okay? You make the assumption that it's very, very old, right? And the C14 that it started with the same proportion as C14 to C12 now, and over the eons, it's been degrading. But there's a massive assumption being made, and that is that 50,000 years ago when that tree died, you are assuming that the C14 ratio in the atmosphere was the same as it is today. It's a fundamental assumption. That means that 50,000 years ago this tree died with the same 5% C14, right, as a tree today. And over 50,000 years, the 5% is broken down to 0.0005. But who was around 50,000 years ago to say, right, that the ambient level in the atmosphere was the same as it is now? Scientifically, and the further back you go, the longer, the older things you want to date, the weaker becomes your assumption, right, that the level in the atmosphere is the same. Postulate, for example, to yourself a system in which C14 is not constant. Let's assume, for argument's sake, that there is more and more and more and more C14 all the time being formed. Assume it's possible, right? Which would mean, the further back in time you go, the less and less and less C14 there would be around until you reach some time point zero. Let's assume that time point zero is not so long ago, not 50,000 years. Let's assume 10,000 years ago, right? There was no C14 around. It's possible. We don't know. And the tree died then. You now have a 10,000-year-old tree with zero C14, right? Why? Because when it died, there was no C14 around for it to have inside it. You measure it now, and you date it 50,000 years or 100,000 years old, right? You with me, everybody? Everybody clear? Now, a few years ago, some fascinating work was done by a French team to check out the assumption. You want to be a scientist? Let's check out the assumption. And they did the following work. They checked out, I have the reference at home if anybody wants it, I can give you the reference of the work. This is what they did. They set out over a period of some years to measure C14 levels in the environment to see if it's constant. Your dating method is not valid unless you can be sure that your tree died whenever it died with the same ratio as you have now, as I've explained to you. So they set out to measure the levels, and they found the following very amazing phenomenon. They found that at one point when they measured the ratio in the atmosphere, they found a certain level of, this is time, right? This axis is time, and this level is percentage of C14. Apologize for the quality of the blackboard. They measured at a certain time, some years ago, the ambient level of C14, controlled set of experiments, and they found it to be a certain percentage. Then sometime later, they measured the C14 percentage again, and they found it was not constant. Not at all. In fact, it had gone up.
I'm
exaggerating the slope of the curve, right? Just to put it to my graph.
They found that C14 levels were now higher.
They were very surprised, and they measured it again sometime later.
And they found that the level was higher.
And they kept doing these experiments and measuring the C14 percentage, a very sensitive equipment.
And they found that the level of C14 over an observed period of time in our lifespan is increasing.
But not only is it increasing, it's increasing at a set rate. And there's a straight line graph which defines its rate of increase. And they were able to explain it. Because the formation of C14, as I mentioned before, depends on energetic cosmic radiation reaching the Earth and energizing or exciting C12 atoms into the state of C14. The more time that goes by, the more C14 is generated. And the rate of generation of C14 exceeds its natural half-life breakdown, right, at a fixed ratio. So they found a straight line graph. And then they did something fascinating. They projected the line backwards, which is not valid scientifically, but it's interesting to do. And they projected the line backwards to a time zero. And you know when that graph hit time zero? 5,700 years ago. I can give you the reference. Fascinating piece of work. Now, nobody claims that proves the world's 5,700 years old, because the same inherent arguments apply against this piece of work as we are raising against the conventional assumption. Who says that the rate of increase is constant? Maybe over the 10 years that they measured it, the rate was constant, but maybe 15 years ago, or 100 years ago, it took a loop, a dive, went up, and we don't know. It's fascinating to speculate about, but we wouldn't lay any bets on that phenomenon. Now, the underlying point here, is anyone not clear on the scientific process? You're not clear.
I have a question about that. Now, you say it's going at a straight line increasing, but now the more C14 you have, more C14 is
being converted
to C12, right?
At a fixed rate.
Right.
The half-life remains constant.
Right. But
the ratio, you must know that there's a fixed ratio, fixed relationship between the increase of C14 and its natural breakdown. And the one exceeds the other, such that there's a net increase in C14 according to a predictable formula.
But you're saying that the increase...
I think it's a straight line, yeah. It's certainly mathematics.
It should be going up, right? Why?
Because
the amount of C12 going to C14 is going to be governed by, you know, the sun hitting the atmosphere or whatever. But the amount of, but you're going to have a bigger amount of C14 going to C12 as you have more C14, true.
But you have a fixed half-life. Half-life doesn't describe amounts. They describe that whatever amount you start with, at a given time, you'll have half.
That's right. But if you have more C14, then you have more C14 going to C12.
But not ratio-wise. But check the report. I can't guarantee you it's a straight line. I can guarantee you, though, that it's a predictable mathematical relationship, which is the same thing. Straight line is also a mathematical equation. Speak to me afterwards. I'll give you the thing. You can look it up. The paper's in French, so, you know, I've only read an analysis of it, but check it out. But we're not here to prove that the world's 5,700 years old by this technique. It's open to all the problems of extrapolation and so forth. All I'm trying to show is that to use a technique which is based on a massive assumption, a person has to remain open-minded and say that if the assumption's true, then the facts are true. But if the assumption's not, we don't know. So the whole system we're working with is an assumption. Now, all radioactive dating methods are based on assumption. Radio-argon dating, right? And various other methods are all based on the fact that what happened when we say it happened, right, happened under the same conditions which happen now. And I'll come back to this point in a moment. Now, the current theories dating the age of the Earth are split into two camps. Okay, one, I'm sure you all know, two cosmological theories. One known as the steady state theory and one known as the Big Bang theory, right? The steady state theory being that the universe has always existed. There are tremendous philosophical problems with such a position, but that's the idea. The more currently accepted theory is that about 10 billion years ago, the universe originated in a Big Bang, from what no one knows, okay? But originated in the Big Bang. There are tremendous, there's a wealth of scientific information to support this. And there's still tremendous argumentation about exactly how it happened. According to one theory, the universe expanded to 30 million times its original volume in the first 30 millionths of a second, okay, which generates certain very interesting mathematical consequences. It makes the universe very flat, which is a term used to describe the fact that physical laws apply constantly throughout the universe. Very interesting things dealing with relativity and so forth. And be that as it may, something known as the Big Bang Theory, which puts the age of the universe commonly accepted these days at about 10 billion years, which is 10,000 million years old. This age range varies tremendously according to the authorities, but that's what's said. Age of the Earth, did I say age of the universe? Age of the Earth, 10 billion years. And the origin of life on Earth, about half that time ago. Right? First signs of life, in the most primitive form, about 5 billion years ago, 5,000 million years, more or less. Now, tremendous problems. First of all, evolution-wise, that's much too little time. Okay? According to the evolutionists, that's not enough time to have evolved the complexity that we see. It's not enough time to have evolved one enzyme. It's a tremendous problem. This is well worked out, and this research is, anyone interested in it specifically, in 1964 there was a mathematical congress known as the Wistar Conference, which analyzed it in great detail. That can be, you can read that. And fascinating work by a religious thinker called Spetner, published in Nature over the last 20 years, also analyzing the mathematical phenomena involved. Be that as it may, that's the theory. Now, problems, evidence, both sides of the fence, that's how it is. Torah says that we know the world is 5,748 years ago. That's a tremendous discrepancy. Now, both these, the scientific thing, as we said before, ranges back to an area of extrapolation. We can't measure it directly. There are no records from those days. No one was around. And therefore, we're working in the dark. Human history goes back, as I'm sure you're aware, no more than 5,000 years, right? Ebla in Syria and places that have been uncovered recently, which have human and cultural remains, date back no more than 5,000 years, right? So we have verification at least for that. But further back than that, we don't know. How do Torah thinkers reconcile these two positions, right?
Yeah.
I'm not sure what methods they use for those things. They might use simple historical methods, like knowing, you know, cultural development, things like that. I really don't know. See, carbon dating only works on organic material. Cannot date the Ebla tablets and things like that, which are made out of clay and so forth, to the best of my knowledge, by those methods. I don't know. I really don't know. This is published in the popular press, by the way, over the last few years. This is, you can read quite a lot. Rabbi Bech has mentioned to me a very interesting book which you can read on this subject. She goes into these methods of dating and so forth. Dr. Bronner.
Archaeological
methods.
Not
from organic. I see. So you want to look up these cultural type things, you can look up in that book, which is called
Biblical Personalities in Archaeology,
tying together archaeological findings with a biblical record and showing how they're consistent. What points of view, what lines can we take to reconcile these points of view? The one easy, you know, the obvious and easy thing is to say science is completely wrong. Right? They're talking about 1,000 million years, 5,000, 10 billion years, etc. Completely wrong. They're fooled into making wrong observations in the line that we've tried to set up now. That's a possibility. And you should know, incidentally, most Torah thinkers do not take that line, but you should know that there is a extensive body of scientific opinion that takes that line. A television program was made a few years ago gathering together many of the leading scientific minds who happen to think that the scientific evidence shows that the world's about 10,000 years old, which is not bad in terms of agreement with 7,500. Leading thinkers in the United States and in England, evidence from the age of the moon, for example, right, the layer of dust on the moon. There's a layer of dust gathering on the moon, right, which according to 10 billion years, according to the age postulated by the Big Bang Theory and by the age of the Earth, as it's accepted in conventional scientific circles, should be much, 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 much deeper. In fact, there was a lot of anxiety during the moon landing, I'm sure you're aware, that if it had been correct, the lunar module would have sank hopelessly below the surface of the moon, right? But the layer of dust was found to be only consistent with no more than 10,000 years of deposition of dust. Once again, we have to understand that these are also based on assumptions that deposition has been constant. And many of these scientists put together their theories by using many different things where they feel confident that the assumptions, when taken together, give some reasonable degree of accuracy. There's no way of checking that either. But I just want you to know, there is a highly respected body of pure scientists
Peirce, apart from religious fundamentalists whose opinion is suspect in these areas, is a vested interest, are pure scientific thinkers who put the age of the Earth with a radical suggestion at no more than 10,000 years. Fascinating work in this area, that based on the age of the Moon, based on many other observations. Now, and they answer the carbon dating methods and so forth by one of a number of arguments, such as, for example, what we've used here and other methods as well. That's one line of thinking. There are other possibilities. There are Torah sources which talk about worlds before this one. The well-known Torah sources which say that when Hashem created this world, He created many worlds and destroyed them before this world, like sparks that flew up from a blacksmith's anvil. And there are at least some well-respected Torah authorities who say that prehistoric worlds that we have evidence of were these worlds. In other words, the physical body of the earth was the same one and has been existing perhaps for millions and millions of years, but the forms of life as we know them were created and destroyed, right? Extinctions, various other ice ages, whatever they want to say. The most famous of these, to my knowledge, is a well-known Tiferes Yisrael, which can be found in the back of the usual copy of the Mishnah, right, which they reprint in Shabbos HaGadol Drosha, and in there he mentions explicitly a mammoth found in Siberia, frozen mammoth found in Siberia, and which the natural historians say died X millions of years ago, perfectly preserved in the ice, right? Millions of years old, hundreds of thousands, I don't know exactly how old, perfectly preserved in the ice. It's very sure brings this as a possible proof that there were worlds that are unknown to us that existed before our present world. Yeah.
Now, even though we count our calendar from when man was created, the stuff that made up the world could have been from other worlds.
That's what he says. Yeah, that is this idea. It's not accepted by the majority of Torah thinkers. I wouldn't say this is the main approach to this issue, but you should know there is such an opinion. Yes.
How does that coincide with creating light and darkness, from the void?
That they would explain the 6 days of creation to be the world as we know it. Understand? That there was a world that we don't know. Well, maybe it's called, maybe that's metaphorical, maybe something else, we don't know. There's a general principle you should know in the 6 days of creation that's called Kavod Elokim Hester Dovah, right? That the honor of Hashem in the process of creating the world is hidden from us. We cannot know what the Torah is really talking about back then. There's a much more cogent way perhaps to approach that statement, and I'll try and get to it in a moment. But since we're working in the dark, as it were, back then, we don't know whether it's metaphorical or literal, but we don't know exactly.
Yeah,
I believe that's a Midrash. Now, but it's well known and well accepted. Now, there's another line apart from that taken by the Tiferes Yisrael, and that's a very challenging and unorthodox and radical suggestion, which is the following suggestion. It's been made by serious thinkers. Once again, far from the mainstream approach that Torah thinkers take to this problem, but it's a theoretical possibility, and it has been raised. The suggestion is as follows. The world is 5,748 years old, as we know it, and there was nothing before. Yesh me'ayin, not previous forms, not extinct forms, not a world that we're not familiar with. The world, exactly as we know it. A globe, an earth, exactly, and before that, nothing. But there are fossils and findings on earth, which appear to be dated millions of years old by a number of different methods and techniques. And the idea is like this. You know what Hashem did? He created the world 5,748 years ago with fossils. Listen, ready-made evidence of millions of years. Why not? He created Adam 40 years old or whatever he was. He didn't create him as an embryological speck who then grew to adulthood. He created him as a fully-fledged man. So he created the world as a fully-fledged world. You understand? With sea fossils in the mountains, as if there had once been a flood there. And with fossils of extinct creatures who never lived, but were created then and fossilized already. Now, why would he do such a thing? Why would he pull such a trick on us? To give us the free will of having to struggle with the Torah account of how old the world is, against respective scientific thinkers who say it's millions of years old, and to give us an ordeal or maybe some other reason that we can't fathom. And that's the argument. Now, there's absolutely no logical reason why it could not be true, but it's stretching, right? It's stretching the conventional approach to these things, and it's by no means the main body of Torah thinking takes that on.
It seems to me that two of those arguments, particularly the last one, it's particularly, although you say an absolute body of time, perhaps not, but I mean, do those arguments arise for two reasons. The first reason is because you feel we've got to sort of reconcile it and say the Torah.
You know, I don't see why it's necessary to ever have to speculate that, because, you know, it could happen, but you have to get the answer for that, and, you know,
absolutely.
So we don't take the shoes like that. You know, although there are some Torah views where they say the world is only 6 years old, to me, it seems that what the atheist say, the scientists, they will say, okay, you're absolutely right in what you say, but we still think the world is only 6 years old, so we made the assumption that there are reasonable assumptions to make unless there's other evidence to show contrary. And they say, there isn't any other evidence. Now, therefore, they not include the possibility, one, that the world was created just like that, right? They haven't considered the possibility that we actually know how old the world is and counting from day one. And for instance, we know that since the point of the flood, let's just say the Torah is true, since the point of the flood, conditions have changed.
Sure.
Because people used to live to, let's say, 900 years old or whatever, and then after the flood, they just drastically went down to our sort of time scale. So if those things are true, then that's a truism to say, therefore, they're calculations
should be wrong. Sure, sure, that's exactly correct. What you just raised about the flood and so forth is often raised in these previous lines of thinking that I've taken to show that we have a Torah account which says this very thing, that the nature of reality was different in bygone times. For example, before the flood, as you said, we know that that things look very different. Before the flood, for example, the human physiology was completely different. Man was not allowed to eat meat back then. Animals were completely different. People lived a completely different type of lifespan, many hundreds of years. There were many differences. There's a famous Chazanish which shows this, even in a relatively short time span, that the human biological organism, right, in the last 2,000 years of the existence of the world, which is called the Muslim Mashiach, is different from what it was in the middle 2,000, which is known as the Shnei Alafim Shel Torah. That there were different physiological processes that happened then, and we cannot make any halakhic decisions on what we see today. Because the reality, according to Torah, which was the perfect design of the world, was the way the world functioned up to and including that point. And the fascinating differences to which these things apply. There are many Gemaras, for example, which deal with fascinating aspects of childbirth. Right? Things that cause a child to be born exactly at a certain way, at a certain time, all kinds of things which we do not see today. And we give them the credit for having made accurate observations. At least that, if you don't want to get into the Kabbalistic and a deeper insight. Now there, the Chazanish says quite clearly, is that the human organism looks completely different. And by the way, in medicine, we have axioms that are based on that. If the Gemara, for example, mentions a drug to be used for a certain thing, the halakhic principle is that if modern medicine mentions something else, we take the modern version. You have to be very careful where to apply that. It's only in this area. We don't just knock out Gemara for science to say something different. Far from it. But there's certain areas where it depends on the Shinui HaGuf changes in what's taken place in the last. So there's a lot of evidence you can amass for the argument that things were different at different times, and therefore to extrapolate backwards, even only to 6,000 years ago, 5,000 years ago, is totally invalid. Kol Shekain, back to thousands and millions of years ago. Now, let me just tell you one more line, which is a very cogent line of thinking, which many Torah thinkers have taken, and I wish to present this to you as perhaps a more... that sticks together in our minds better than many of the other things I've said. Let me first present this, and then I wish to tell you some very fascinating facts which contradict the scientific things as well, which no one's managed to explain. But first of all, there's a line of thinking that goes like this. This involves a touch of philosophical understanding, but it's a very basic and fundamental issue. The mystics talk about the time span of the 6 days of creation very differently from the way we understand time now. Right? Remember the verse in Tehillim, which the Leshem and others quote, which says that 1,000 years now is like a day was then. Right? That a day in the sight of Hashem is like 1,000 years in our eyes. This and other sources are used to show that the concept of time, that means the time, as you know, is really just an abstract concept, right? The only way we have any grasp of time is by measuring change with what's called time, right? If there's no physical change, there's no concept of time. You're aware of that, right? The only way we measure time is by measuring the rate of change of some variable. the rate of change of variables in the 6 days of creation was much, much, much faster than it is now. Which means that you may well have lived through what was called 6 days, you understand, which the modern measure of time would call millions of years. They're both one and the same thing. If you ask us only think about it for a moment to see that this is really only the only basic way to think about the problem. For example, the Torah says that Hashem created the first day, and then the second day, and then the third day. You know what He created on the fourth day?
The sun.
The sun and the moon. And the Torah says that the sun and the moon were created, lemoyadim, to mark times, to mark days and weeks and months and years. Which means that there was no creation of days, months, weeks and years marked by the cycle of solar phenomena, right before, and yet we're talking about the first 3 days. So the first 3 days of creation, no matter how you cut it, are some kind of mystical reference to a day, at a stage, which is very hard to interpret as 24 hours as we know them. There was no concept of measurement, there was no sun and moon. The earth, in the most abstract mystical sense, there was no differentiation of any aspect of the creation. Yes, the Torah is quite clear that on the second day, the whole concept of division was created. Nothing was separated out on the first day. What on earth, what kind of day was that? You understand? So that... So the mystics usually say that the place where Torah is referring to one day being 1,000 years is when Adam was created. Which means that even as close as we can get in the 6 days, which means the last few hours that Adam was supposed to live through, right, was the last few hours of a day which would have appeared to us like 1,000 years. But if you go back to the first day and the fourth day, you go back before time, before sun and moon were hanging in the skies. What are you talking about? So the events which happened then in the coming into being of the world, a better way to say it, which you can hear very well, is that the Torah concept is that the world was created in 6 days, which means everything. Absolutely everything. Absolutely everything, which means even the laws themselves. Even the laws of nature. Even the laws of physics. Which means that when you... Listen, hold very carefully. When you're considering the first 6 days of creation, you are talking about a world coming into being. Not a world that is here already. A world that is being generated. A world in which the laws of physics do not apply because they're only now being created. You understand? So to apply the laws of physics as they are now, back into a phase where the laws didn't apply yet, they weren't there yet. You understand? It's not that the whole world's created in the first instance and instantaneously everything applied. No, that's not how it happened. Over something that is called 6 days, which we do not understand, we do not know what that means, a sequence of things happened, at the end of which the world was clicked into the rules, regulations, and phases that we understand now. Since I can see it, right? I'm so important, it must always have applied, even in the 6 days when the very world itself was being brought into existence. It doesn't make any sense at all. And therefore, this line of thinking says that what was laid down in those first days, not that Hashem created the world with fossils already, but He created a 6 days in which the changes, you understand, took what was called 6 days by the Torah, but which we read as many millions of years. Which means that the dating systems were accurate within the terms of reference that they used, within the terms of the assumptions that they're based on, the dating systems are accurate. And that is... a lot of profit to be had in thinking along these lines. The answer is many, many problems. I want to mention one.